Hola, this is Elvis, the Mexican Elvis. You are listening to the Devil's Music.
Pantheon Podcasts presents from Hollywood, California, the Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you the Devil's Music.
Hey there, this is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to the Devil's Music, a Pantheon podcast. A little bit about me. I'm a punk rock witch from Hollywood, California. I've had a lifelong passion for rock and roll and the occult that started when I was a preteen. In the 70s, I was one of the first punks in LA, and as a teenager, I worked at the Whiskey a Go-Go, started producing shows, and made a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led me to write for every major rock publication you could think of. In the 80s and the 90s, I fronted three bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've toured around the globe to teach and perform dance. You might have also seen me acting or dancing in music videos, feature films, and documentaries. Look for me in the new Go-Go's documentary. To find out more about me or to book a tarot reading, go to my website, pleasantgaiman.com. I'm really excited to be part of the Pantheon Podcasts network of rock and roll shows. Everyone here at Pantheon tells stories about the music we just adore so much, each and every one with a different twist. Find them all wherever you listen to podcasts, at Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Pandora, anywhere you get your favorite podcast fix. And head on over to pantheonpodcast.com to share a show with a friend. Or be damned to purgatory forever. Hi, this is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to The Devil's Music. Today, my guest is someone I've known for years. He was absolutely influential in the early 80s LA punk scene, from his famous and infamous record store, Vinyl Fetish, to the clubs he co-ran and created, making alternative nights before that term was actually in use. Nowadays, he'd be called an influencer. Please welcome Joseph Brooks. Hi, Joseph.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm working hard and enjoying every minute of it.
Joseph makes really amazing jewelry, too, but we'll get into that later because I know that everyone listening wants to hear about all the 80s crazy, crazy stuff going on. So, I don't even know this. Are you from LA? How do I not know this?
I grew up in New York City. And then in 71, I moved to Northern California because of some legal matters in New York that made me have to leave. And I ended up in Northern California and got into the scene in San Francisco in the 70s and then ended up in LA. I moved to LA officially in 78. After visiting several times and meeting a lot of the people here, and then at the famous Sex Pistols show at Winterland, met a huge group of LA people that talked me into it and said, you've got to move to LA. So between all of that, I ended up here in 78 and have been here ever since.
Yeah, everybody, there was like a mass migration up to San Francisco for that Sex Pistols show. Like
everybody realized, like, if you were going to ever see them, this was it. Even though we didn't know it was the final show, we all felt like this is the final show for the U.S. tour. And if we ever had a chance to see them, this was going to be the one.
Do you remember how much the tickets were? I still have mine.
No.
They were $3. No. And that was really expensive.
I don't remember that. $3. Yeah. That was incredible. Wow.
And Kid Congo and I were, we drove up with Teresa Carriquez and uh-huh. Kay and a bunch of people all crammed into Teresa's Honda. And we were all on hallucinogenics. And I remember the line was around the block. And Kid and I just like, we just walked to the front of the line and just wandered in and nobody stopped. And you know, that kind of thing that happens only when you're tripping, you know, like no one said anything. So we just went in there.
Right. So yeah, I had a partner back then named Henry who we went to the show together, and he had come down to LA previous to that to see the Damned at Starwood. And I couldn't go because I had work. And he came back and told me about LA and all the amazing people he met here at the Starwood show. And so then at Winterland, all those people were there and he introduced me to everybody. And I distinctly remember that's where I met Kid, was that night.
Yeah. Yeah, that, we were all so privileged to experience that stuff then, you know, especially the overseas things, because touring back then wasn't the same as it is now for bands, you know?
And my first LA experience was coming down here was to see the three nights at the Whiskey of the Ramones.
Oh, yeah.
With two shows every night, an early show and a late night show. And Blondie opened all six shows. I went to all six shows. And then afterwards, you know, Tomato had that party at his house.
Oh, my God. Yes. Talk about that, because that party was so fucking insane.
It was so influential to me because it really solidified why I wanted to be here. And Tomato knew that I wasn't from here. And he made a point of taking me around arm in arm, introducing me to everybody there, because he was sort of like the unofficial mayor of the scene. Like, he was so important to everybody and everyone respected him so much. And he made a point of making sure that I was comfortable, that I knew everyone, that I was going to be okay, and that I was going to move here. So he, you know, more than any one person, really was my introduction to the LA scene and why I ended up living here.
I remember when Joan Jett and Randy Kaye, my Lobotomy co-editor, we were sitting in the balcony at the Whiskey at those Blondie and Ramone shows, which we went to every single one of them all week long, like how you did. Uh-huh. And we saw Tomato and Gear standing on the dance floor, and our heads just swiveled, and we were all just, who the fuck is that? Because Tomato, I'm talking about Tomato from the Screamers, for anyone that's listening, the most legendary LA punk band that never really got recorded.
My favorite.
Everyone's favorite from LA. And I feel so sorry for any of you guys that weren't in LA then, which was legions of you, but they were definitely immortal. But Tomato was wearing like this 50s red suit jacket, and he had a giant like wooden coat hanger shoved in the back of it. And Gear had on a black leather jacket and their hair was standing straight up like the Screamers logo. And like Joan and Randy and I just sort of walked down like we were on Lost in Space or some sci-fi show, just looking at like the new aliens that had arrived on the planet.
And totally.
They were so nice.
They were the nicest. They were everything. And not only were they wonderful and their house was iconic, but their band, once you saw them, it was everything else just looked like ordinary and tame. And they were so like futuristic and like nothing we had seen before. And they blew your mind. They were so good. And I just, you know, can't say enough good things about them.
Yeah. And so that party that night at the Wilton Hilton, the Screamers house.
Yeah.
I remember all of Blondie and the Ramones being there and smoking smoking joints with Debbie Harry and Joey Ramone.
Uh-huh.
And Debbie got so high that she started to fall over. And Randy said, "What are you doing?" And Debbie said, "I was just smelling that tree." And we were looked at each other because we just seen her on stage like such a goddess all week long,
right?
She was like more dorky than we were,
right, but it made you love her more. Like it was just like she was so real and so sweet, and meeting her there that night too, also that was what I remember the most about it, was like, oh, she's just like us. She's like,
and
there is also cool,
so beautiful, you know? Like,
yeah amazing. And I met Danny Fields there. And you know, I used to silk screen a lot of shirts and stuff for shows, because my whole thing was I was a big fan. You know, I went to all this because I was a fan. Like, that was who I was from like early on as a kid. Like, I was a music fan and I would go see shows and I'd follow bands around. And that was just like the way it was. And I used to silk screen a lot of t-shirts for shows, and so that I would have a shirt that no one else had and stuff. And I made Ramones shirts and I gave them to them that night. And I remember they were really happy with them because I had put like American Eagle wings on them.
Oh, cool.
On the Ramones. And I met Arturo, who had designed their logos and stuff that time too. And I remember Dee Dee saying that he was really happy that I put the wings on, the American Eagle wings on him. He was really happy about that. And I gave them all t-shirts and I got them to sign the shirts. And then I took one of the Ramones shirts, because a couple of weeks later, Andy Warhol came to LA and was signing posters in Venice at Ace Gallery. And we went and I was wearing my Ramones shirt that I made. And I got Andy Warhol to sign my Ramones shirt, and I got him to write 1, 2, 3, 4, like Dee Dee would say, like 1, 2, 3, 4. And it says 1, 2, 3, 4, Andy Warhol.
Oh my God.
Under the Ramones picture. I still have it.
I still have a leather jacket that Debbie Harry signed from that same time on the inside. And we had just interviewed her for Lobotomy, my fanzine. And And she wrote on the inside of it, "Vomit Lobotomy," and she spelled lobotomy with an A, like just accidentally. And it says like XXOO, love Deb. And then that jacket was lost for like, I don't know, 35 years or something. And Anna Statman returned it to me because she had found it in a paper bag in her mom's garage from when she was helping me move out of my punk house, Disgrace. And she brought it to me in the middle of an art show I was having of Lobotomy stuff. And she said, "Here, this is for you." And she just gave it to me like in this paper bag. And I had no idea what it was. And I opened it up and I screamed so loud that security ran into the room because they thought a fight had broken out.
Wow. That's a fantastic story.
Yeah.
I love that. That's amazing. Yeah, you mentioned Randy. Randy ended up working for me with me at Vinyl Fetish, like my record store. Like, he was one of our first, if not our first employee that we hired. Randy, amazing.
Let's talk about Vinyl Fetish, because for anybody listening, Vinyl Fetish was like the coolest record store on the face of the planet. Like, you had in-store appearances of insane people, like
everybody. Nowadays
they'd be mobbed, like Susie and the Banshees.
We did everything we could to meet the bands. You know, we were fans. Henry and I were fans. We would try to get backstage. We'd try to meet people. We went to England to see bands before bands had record deals. You know, we saw everybody before they even put out a single, you know, because we heard about these scenes that were happening and we wanted to see it, you know, for ourselves. And I remember we were living in Northern California. I used to call CBGBs and ask the girl at the door to hold the phone out so I could hear what the band sounded like.
Oh my God, that's so amazing.
Because there were no records. There was no internet. There was nothing, you know. And we went to England in 78 and we went and we saw everybody, you know, Adam and the Ants and Susie and the Banshees and you name it, before they ever had records out.
Yeah.
And then we met some people that had record stores in England and we were like, oh my God, this is what we want to do when we get back home. And we went into this one record store on King's Road and we were pulling records out of the bins. And the guy goes, can I help you? I go, we're going to buy these. And he goes, you are? And so I said, yeah, do you have a box? You have a cardboard box? And we filled up boxes full of records. And he's like, what is this for? And they go, like, it's for my personal collection. And it was. And he goes, well, you should think about maybe, you know, I could help you open a record store in L.A. You know, I could help you get records sent over. He was working for Beggar's Banquet at the time. And he was Bauhaus's manager. It was before Bauhaus, though. But he took us out. He says, I have a car. You want to see bands? I'll take you around. He took us to the Splits, and every band that was playing, we went and saw them. Wire, you name it, we saw them, and it was so much fun. And then we came back to L.A., and we started saving our money up to open a record store, and we rented the space on La Brea at first, and we didn't have enough money to buy records yet, so we used to have, like, performance art in the space. So we had, like, Johanna Wendt one night, we had Priscilla B one night, and then one night we showed a movie. Exine's sister was here with a movie she made, Ecstatic Stigmata.
That's
and
right, so I remember that.
We showed that movie. We would use the space for everything, and then we had enough money to buy a handful of records. So we opened the store, we had maybe 50 records. That's all we could afford at the time, you know, and we grew from there, and we were trying to do things where it was mostly imports and it was mostly records you couldn't get anywhere else. So, because we were fans, we wanted to get them for ourselves. So when records would come in, we'd go like, okay, one for us, one for the store, one for us, one for the store. And then we started contacting the bands that we had met and said, hey, you want to do a record signing? And we can host it. And the first one we ever did was X when their album came out, because they were a local band and we knew them.
Yeah.
And so we had X come to the store and they signed their record. And this was the very first one we did. And then the second one we did like Cabaret Voltaire and Young Marble Giants, two English bands that were playing at Soco Hall.
I remember I was at the store for I think for both of those. And Soco Hall, I'm going to explain this to the audience. They're like LA punk or almost any kind of punk wasn't getting covered in American music magazines and papers. So, and clubs were very leery of having anything that they thought was punk, even if it wasn't, you know, like hardcore punk. So, like the club that Joseph just mentioned, Soco Hall, we always wound up having shows in banquet halls or weird, like, you know, spaces. So there was you know, there was always like, you know, like the Elks Lodge. A lot of you have heard about the Elks Lodge riot, but there was so many other weird little, there was Bases Hall, there was like the Ukrainian halls. Anyway, we should take a little break right now and we'll be back in a second with Joseph. We're going to listen to some music and we'll be right back.
Special effects by lunatic and drinks. The graveyard scene. The golden years. She's in Paris. It's a
can. Hi, we're back.
So yeah, so we started doing in-stores, yeah, and we did the a lot of them, and then we did one. Then the record company started contacting us and saying, "Hey, we have this English band coming. Would you host them?" And it was bands we knew because we were selling the import singles. So we had, you know, Psychedelic Furs when their first singles came out in England. We had them when they played the Whiskey. And then we had U2, and maybe 25 people showed up. Nobody knew who they were. Hardly anybody showed up to have their record signed. I have photos of what the store looked like with U2 in it. And it's just like, there's not 25 people in the store. It's really like hilarious. And then we outgrew that space and we found a space on Melrose, a bigger place. And then we moved the record store there. And then that's where we really started kicking off in 1980. We had, you know, everybody, you name it. We had times where we had record signings where the street would get closed down. There was that many people that would spill out from the sidewalk across the street and traffic couldn't get by.
I remember that. That was crazy. Like, and it, like I would always come to a lot of the, you know, the signings and the in-store appearances, uh-huh. But sometimes you'd be like two blocks away and, you know, on the bus and be like, wow, thank God I don't have to park for this shit. You know, like that was really the beginning. You were like in on the beginning of like the whole quote, quote, Melrose Avenue scene, you know, like one of the first cool stores down there before it turned into like music and fashion central.
Yeah, we were there early and that's why we could afford it because the rents went crazy. But, you know, we were there and across the street from us was Let It Rock and down the street was Helen's retail slot. And there was like this core of people would go to all these stores and Poser. So people would go shopping on Melrose, would hit our store, clothing stores, punk stores, and all in the same time. And you know, I mean, we had the most amount of people, I think, was for the Damned. When they showed up, it was like literally thousands of people on the street trying to get in. And Iggy came and signed his book when he did that book, I Need More, his autobiography. He came and painted his face and signed books. And we had all the Ramones. We had, you know, Susie two times or three times. The Cult, Culture Club, Depeche Mode, Duran Duran. All of these bands the first time they came to America. Bauhaus, Love and Rockets. All of these bands the first time they showed up in L.A. From England. We got them to come and sign records and do an appearance. And it was very exciting stuff because no one was doing anything like that. And we were fans. And so we were like appealed to what the fans wanted. And people wanted that. People really wanted to be able to come and get something signed. And it was fun.
And no mainstream places were doing that at all. And then that, let's talk about also like the clubs that that you started doing. Like, I remember The Veil, I think that was the first one. So The Veil, yeah. it was sort of at the beginning of, it was like a combo, like, correct me if I'm wrong, Joseph, it was like a combo but of like, quote, quote, death rock, which was what goth was kind of being called at the time. And it was just sort of also, you know, a hybrid with sort of new romantic stuff. And that was at Cafe de Grand, where I was booking at the time. And so describe
we were doing the record store, and then we had a radio show once a week on K-Rock with Dusty Street. It was called The Import Show. So we would have 1 hour where we would play our favorite top seven singles from England. And we would leave the records with them and say, here, you can have these and you can play them during the week. And we played for the first time in America, you know, Bauhaus, Duran Duran, Depeche Mode, all of this stuff, like the first singles, like we played them on the air. And then we said, well, why can't we do a club with this and people could dance to this? So we wanted it to be special. So we wanted it to, nobody did that then, except for Rodney had done that already in the 70s, you know, where you got dressed up. And you went out and you danced to your favorite records. And they weren't like the records you hear on the radio or the top 40. They were like alternative, what they called records. So we hosted these nights. And the first one we did was called The Veil. And it was at Cafe de Grand, which was a punk venue. And so, you know, like one night would be Fear, one night would be us. You know, it would be like, so it was really out of context. And people really went all out in dressing up. People spent like a week to make an outfit to wear the next week. And we, you know, we were children of Bowie, and we, you know, so we were very always interested in that kind of glamour or glam rock, or so we incorporated that. So like in the club in the beginning, we were playing like T-Rex and Roxy Music and Bowie, and but we were mixing it with all this new stuff that was coming out. So it was, you know, it was based on, in the beginning, was very heavily new romantic. So then it evolved. And then the Cafe de Grand, Dobbs and those people that ran it were incredibly shady to us. And we thought, let's get out of here. And we walked down the street from Cafe de Grand. And we walked into lingerie where nobody cared about any at all. Nobody went there. They had no business. And we said, hey, we're getting like, you know, huge amounts of kids showing up. Would you be willing to host our night? And they said, yeah, because they needed the business. And we said we'd guarantee that they would do like X amount of dollars at the bar. And sure enough, we did The Veil at Cafe de Grand, and it was like huge lines around the block. And then we started doing it two nights a week. And then we decided like we needed to switch it. So then we changed the name of it. And we called it the Fetish Club. And that's when it was like real gothy. But in those days, it was called Death Rock.
Yes.
And, you know, we geared it more towards that stuff. So it was more like Susie and Bauhaus and Sisters of Mercy. And it was more going in that direction because we were following music trends. And then we moved it from there next door to the Berwyn Entertainment Complex, which is now the Hollywood Athletic Club.
Yeah.
And then we started to have live bands. So then we had like Christian Death and Red Cross and who else? Oh, we had, it was a band, it was friends of ours did, it was called Billy Wisdom.
Oh, that's right.
Remember, yeah. Billy Wisdom?
Yeah, yeah.
And we had them play because they did a total Ziggy Stardust live show that was amazing, and it was made up of guys from all other bands like Monitor and Human Hands and all these other, a lot of those Pasadena friends of ours that had bands in the punk days back there. And so they did this like total glam show. It was called Billy Wisdom and the Heeshies.
Yeah, yeah. Really, I forgot about that.
They were fun.
This is the people nowadays would be horrified.
Right, you couldn't say that.
Billy Wisdom and the Non-Binary Persons.
You're killing me. Yeah, that would be totally true, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, we did all that, and then we started getting more into the rock side of things. And, you know, then we had an in-store with Motley Crue at the record store for their first record on Leather Records.
Yeah.
Where they were signed to Elektra. And we let Nikki and Tommy do a window display. So they did this bondage window display at the record store with like a mannequin all tied up. And our windows were broken that night because of it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But then we started throwing in like Motley Crue with Bauhaus. You know, it was like, wow, we thought it fit. We thought it
worked.
Like, we thought it worked. And we changed the name of the club then to TVC 15. And then, God. And then after that, then I was asked by Ricky and Tammy. They were starting a new club called Cat House.
This is Ricky Rockman. And Tammy Down. So yeah, was that at Osco's or was
that was at
Osco's. So Osco's, you guys, was these are all venues that are no longer in LA. Osco's was huge. It had a big upstairs and downstairs, and your club was downstairs there, right?
Upstairs.
Oh, it was upstairs. Okay. Janice was downstairs
with English Acid.
That's right.
And the cave.
Yeah, I love the cave. It had like stalactites and stalagmites hanging from the ceiling. That was a great place to do hallucinogenics in, I gotta say.
right. So then I did Cat House for God forever and with them. And then, wow. Then after that, I did like a techno industrial club called Cinematic, and we had like, you know, Kitten DeVille and Vidita Vantese and all these people were our go-go dancers.
Yeah.
And Ronnie Athey was our star performance artist, and we were playing, you know, all that, you know, stuff like, you know, Thrill Kill Cult. Then I started doing, I wanted to do a glam revival club, and I did club makeup.
Yeah, let's have a little break then, because we got a lot to talk about with makeup.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Yeah.
All right, Joseph, let's talk about club makeup, because I have stories. Well, everybody that was in LA at the time has stories, but I've got one that was it still makes me teary eyed when I think of it. But makeup was such, for anyone listening, makeup was in the El Rey Theater and a huge venue. And it was anything you could imagine of a glam rock club, a gay club, and a rock and roll club, all like mushed together. People got insanely dressed up. Again, like with Joseph's other endeavors, there was lines around the block to get in. It was absolutely fabulous. The music was incredible, and there was performances there all the time. So take it away, Joseph.
So it was a once a month event, and we would rehearse for a month. And we picked themes each month, and we would deck out the club completely and do a full show, live show on stage with bands. And it was all centered around this. And I would pick the theme and the songs, and then we would find people to do the songs. And one particular night, I think that Pleasant's talking about, we wanted to do a punk night. And yeah. So I contacted Dee Dee, who I had known for a long time, and asked him if he would be kind enough to perform in the punk show, because to me, he is the icon of it all. I mean, I thought he was the greatest. And he agreed to do it. And he sang and performed a medley of Ramon songs, and it was beautiful. And then we had other people perform too and do other punk songs as well. But at the end of the night, I'll never forget sitting in the dressing room with him, and I was there to pay him, and he wouldn't accept any money. And I was like, come on, dude, like, it's okay, you know? And he's like, no, I did this because I wanted to, you know, and I had so much pleasure, and it was so beautiful for me to do this, that I don't want money to come involved in this, and I will not accept any payment. And that turned out to be his last performance he ever gave.
I know, you know, you had me emceeing that night.
Yes.
And, I was like in the middle of introducing him. I think a lot of people already knew he was going to be playing, but I was introducing him, and then he came out on stage and he was getting ready, and I was just talking about the Ramones and all that. And then I kind of like just on the spur of the moment said, I need to do this. And I threw myself down on the floor and I was laying on my belly kissing his sneakers. And I remember looking up and he was looking at me like, what the fuck? I mean, not horrified, but he just kind of couldn't believe that I did that. And then a few days later, he died.
He was gone
2 days right
later.
Now. What?
Yeah. He was gone 2 days later.
Yeah.
That was his last show. And that night, you know, talking to him and hanging out with him, and he came to rehearsals, and he couldn't have been nicer. You know, he came in the daytime and we rehearsed that. And then that night and hanging out with him, and he didn't want anything. You know, he was like, are you okay? Do you want a drink? Do you want? He's like, no, everything's fine. Everything is great. You know, and then not accepting payment. You know, I just thought like, this guy is really a gem. There's like, he's just like a prince. You know, there's nobody like him. I've never experienced something like that. He really meant a lot to me. And then, you know, to find out 2 days later that he was gone, it was just heartbreaking. And I still like think about it too, because that day, a friend of mine had a little girl, my friend Cara, brought her daughter to the rehearsal because her daughter was only 7 and she couldn't come to the nightclub, and she loved the Ramones. This kid, little kid, was a Ramones fan, and she had a little black leather jacket, and she came. I said, well, listen, you can come in the afternoon when we do rehearsals and you can meet Dee Dee, right? And she did a drawing. She did this crayon drawing of Dee Dee and her walking together, holding hands. And she wanted to give it to him. She gave it to him. And then she asked him, she had one of those felt tip metallic markers. And she said, would he sign her little leather jacket that she was wearing? And he took the jacket and he drew a complete, covered every inch of it with sort of Keith Haring-ish kind of graffiti art. He drew all over her jacket and gave it to her. Wow. I mean, and she got to hang out with him that afternoon, and he couldn't have been nicer. So all I keep thinking about, and all I can say is, like, did he know that he wasn't going to be around too much longer? I don't know. You know, it's like, it's hard to say, but it was a fantastic night and I'll never forget it. But we had lots of other great shows. One night the Cult showed up unannounced and they got on stage and played a medley of their hits. It was like amazing. We had, you know, incredible people show up and jam and get in the band and play. And it was a special, and it was a really great club. But, you know, it was sort of like my last great club that I ever did. And after that, I thought, like, I can't top this. It's going to be okay, you know. We used to fly people in from New York. We had the Toilet Boys come and perform a couple of times. And they were so much fun. And it was a fun club. Like, one night we did the Ziggy album from first song to last in order. Things like that.
Yeah.
You know, things that I like doing like that. That was always fun for me.
Yeah, that club was like one of the highlights of all Clubland makeup was, because also the audience was so diverse, as you would say now. Yeah. But even then it was just like everybody. I mean, it kind of went along with like the theme of early punk too. I mean, not intentionally on your part, but it was like, some people don't understand, younger people don't understand like how, I'm saying this in air quotes, like how inclusive everything was. Like, I've had people argue with me like, oh, well, there was like no women doing punk. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Because, you know, some people that aren't as OG as we are just think of, the only thing they think of punk is hardcore, you know?
Right. But there was punk before hardcore. Yeah. And that's when we were involved in it, and what how much it meant to us then, you know. That was, you know, I was talking to, I saw a kid last week, and we were talking about that, with the early scene and how diverse the crowd was, and how it was, a lot of the crowd was art damaged kids, you know, like that we were like, you know, new movies and art and theater, and we like were outcasts in regular society anyway, and we were listening to music that hardly anybody was interested in, and so we were definitely like on the edge of what everything else was happening, and we all came together in this one scene where you almost knew everybody in the room, and everyone felt included. And, well, mostly. I mean, I remember sometimes there was this group of girls that would be a little belligerent at some shows, like at the Whiskey. And I was afraid of them at first. And then I realized, like, oh, wait a minute, they're, like, going to be my best friends. And then they ended up protecting me sometimes when it was later on, when it was more of the hardcore kids would come in. They would be step in and go like, keep your distance, you know, like people like Helen.
Yeah.
You know, like she stood up for me several times. And Darby.
Yeah.
I remember when we went to see PIL at the Olympic Auditorium. Do you remember that show?
Yes, yes, yes.
And we decided to go like really like crazy dressed up. And Henry was wearing platforms and leopard skin and all the hardcore kids, like, because
Henry Peck, Joseph.
Henry Peck was about, my
not
partner.
Henry Rollins.
No. No, he wasn't. Henry Rollins wasn't wearing platforms, but Henry Peck was. And these hardcore South Bay kids came up to us and in front of the auditorium, and they tried to stop us from going in. And then Darby came up in front of us and put his arms around us and walked us in, you know, because, you know, in those days, it was very like the hardcore kids sort of like messed up the scene for me. And
for everybody, that I always try to explain that to people, that most of the people that turned into hardcore punk people were the same assholes that were like throwing garbage at us out the windows of cars or you know, yeah, calling us like homo or Bowie, yeah, or, you know, yeah, what I mean? Like, they were, and then they finally realized that, you know, how cool everything was, but then they still had their dumbass attitude.
Right.
They wrecked it in LA. I mean, I don't know if that's for any other cities, but like they sort of like really smashed the original amazing scene to pieces. And I know everything has to like move on and morph and change, but that, mm-hmm, that change, I'm still resentful of it, like almost 50 years later. Fuck you, motherfuckers.
I'm with you.
I got your back too. No.
Well, we got them back, you know, at our store. You know, people would come in with their records, you know, and go, will you sell this at your store? And we'll go like, fuck no, this is a piece of shit. We wouldn't carry this. Get the fuck. We wouldn't carry any of that stuff. We were like, no way. You know, like, that's trash. You know, we had a bad reputation at that store. We were like, we did, because we were really opinionated. And we had, you know, like people like Randy working for us, who was equally as opinionated and equally, we gave him full, you know, we let him say whatever he wanted. We were like, yeah, if you don't want to sell this record to somebody, or you don't want them in the store, you can tell them to get the fuck out of here. And he would.
Randy was my co-editor in Lobotomy, and he's been passed on for a number of years, but he was so funny and sarcastic. But also, Vinyl Fetish did have a reputation for everyone, you know, for a lot of the clerks just being like bitchy and dismissive. But you were sitting on a gold mine. You could have like charged people, and people that were into like BDSM would have paid to, right, them, whether they were buying a record or not.
So true. I have this really good friend now, Rose. You know Rose Apodaca?
Yes.
She lived in Orange County, and she and her girlfriends would get one of the parents to drive them up to Melrose for the weekend, right? And then they used to stand in front of my store, and they used to dare each other to walk in and ask for a record. And I would be standing behind the counter, like hostile. And she would walk in, and she would be like, who's going to ask for the record? They were all so afraid of us. But, you know, we had Randy, we had Lisa Francher, who had
Frontier Records.
And we had Jet, who also started a label. He was a good friend of kids as well.
Oh, that's right. I remember Jet. And Marcy Blaustein, who went on
and Marcy, to
work with Lydia Lunch. And she also lived at Disgraceland.
Yeah. So we had like people that worked in there that also had similar attitude, you know, like, which we encouraged. We encouraged, like, you know, like, we're here to sell what we consider to be good music, but if you ask something we don't like, you can leave.
Let's take one more little break, and I want to talk to you about when we wound up in Memphis together. We'll be right back.
2006. As I got a gun in his brain.
Okay, so I'm back with Joseph Brooks, who's telling the most outrageous stories on earth. This podcast could go on for 4 hours, this episode, but we're trying to condense it. So let's talk about this, because I want to find out what you thought about this whole thing. Joseph and I had both come separately to Memphis for Elvis Week because Elvis was playing. Wait, you weren't there?
No.
Who was it? Was it only Henry?
Yeah, it was just Henry.
Oh, okay. Oh, so we can't. Well, I can tell you this because you may or may not know this, but I didn't know that Henry was in town, and I was dancing with Elvis, who was playing this week, and I decided to go to Al Green's church, wake up really early after drinking all night, and go to Reverend Al Green's church, which was incredible, and there was a full choir full of beautiful old women like singing, and it was just celestial. And Al Green was like, I mean, he was preaching in that movie kind of Elmer Gantry old school preacher way, but it was like a show. This was like a club on Sunday morning. And when we were leaving it, we saw the guitar player from the band who had a van. And this guy, he had like a big star tattooed on his forehead, and he looked very like he'd been influenced by Jimi Hendrix, and his van was covered in little plastic toys and stuff. And I was standing there looking at it, and then Joseph's partner from Vinyl Fetish, Henry, was there. I can't remember who he was with, but like then we just started talking about church and which of the Psalms were our favorite, or like Al Green, it was insanity.
That's wild. Henry used to collect gospel records.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
He had a huge collection of gospel records.
Oh, see, so that would have made more sense to me back in the day, because I had no idea. And I didn't, you know, it's not like there was other people from Elvis Week going to Al Green's church. Wow, right. That's crazy.
Yeah. And he would go to churches here in LA and South Central. To see like choirs and stuff. I remember, I can't remember her name, but we went and saw somebody. I went with him once. Can't remember. But anyway, it was fun.
He and Jeffrey Lee Pierce used to go down there all the time, not to watch choirs, but to go to the junk stores and get records all the time. You could get those white label, like raunchy, like reggae records with, like, you could tell it was reggae stars because you could recognize the voices and stuff, but they would all be singing like dirty, dirty fucking songs about sex and stuff. I still have some of those somewhere. They were amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a fun.
Yeah.
Cool.
So let's talk about what you're up to now and who you're listening to now and all that, because for anyone that doesn't know Joseph Brooks, you got to follow him. He makes incredible high-end spiritual and gorgeous jewelry out of gems. So how did you get into all of this? I want to know.
When I was a kid, I used to collect rocks, and I was always into that. And believe it or not, I went to college and I graduated with in jewelry and painting. So like I learned in college how to do jewelry, and I kind of got swept away by rock and roll and didn't do it for a really long time. But I always had like this love of nature and the stones that come out of the ground are like so amazing to me. And you know, the music scene changed a lot, and I didn't relate to a lot of the new stuff that was coming out. And I thought, just time for me to do something else. And I started collecting stones again and started making jewelry out of it. And pretty soon it started snowballing and becoming a real, you know, everyday kind of a thing for me. And now it's like full time, every day, all the time. and I sell it all over the world, and I've had great success with it, and people wearing it really appreciate it and really love it and feel connected to the stones. And that just makes me happy when I hear that, when people write to me and tell me like, oh, I got this necklace and it means everything to me. And I just feel the energy of the stone, and it's perfect for me to wear it all the time. And then this year, I did this necklace and Kate Moss wore it. And she wears it all the time. She wears it in an opening in London, an opening in New York, an opening in Paris. She wears it to go shopping. She wears it all the time. And it just on social media, like people were like flipping out and going like, where did you get this necklace? You know, like a big honking crystal on a handmade sterling chain, and people wanted it. And so I started making more and more of them. And these days I make all kinds of jewelry and bracelets and rings and
the Bowie bolt bracelet necklace that you did.
Yeah, I'm wearing one right now. I got this carver in India who said he could do some shapes. So I did the drawing of the classic Aladdin Sane lightning bolt makeup, and I sent it to him. And I said, can you carve this in stone? And so he did. And I launched it for Bowie's birthday in January. And people responded in a huge way to it. And everyone was like, wow, that is such a cool thing, because it combines my love of music and my love of stones all in one. And it just was a great thing for me to do. And I feel really connected to turquoise. And I do a lot with real, authentic Arizona turquoise. I do a lot of jewelry with that. And a lot of crystals. I have connections. I travel a lot and meet people in Brazil and in India, and I buy stones everywhere I go. And I'm having a great time with it. It's sort of like a new career for me. It's
amazing that you did this. I mean, did you ever in the olden days envision that you were gonna become a jeweler? I know.
No, and then people go like, oh, you should open a store. But I learned my lesson with the record store, like that retail is not my strong suit, you know. I will never do that again.
You could be the bitchiest jewelry store ever. Like, forget about, like, you know, Van Cleef and Arpels or Tiffany's. You could be cussing people out of your store.
Right. I just get the fuck out of here. No, I, you know, like, I'm changed. I'm not that person anymore. But I also can't deal with the public. You know, I still like doing, like, being a DJ, you be in the booth and you don't have to deal with people. You know, that was my way of doing it. You know, I really liked it. Being in the record store, being behind the counter and go like, okay, what do you want? It's okay. But engaging with people in a retail setting, I'm just not interested in doing that. And it's not suited for me anyway. You know, I like being here in my studio and making jewelry and then sending it out into the world and people loving it and finding it. I'm very happy with that setup.
Since we're talking about not speaking to people, I just want to ask you about one more thing before we go, because this is fascinating to me. Joseph is an avid bird watcher, and it's so many people from punk rock are involved with birds. Me too. I mean, hashtag me too. No, so when you're on your trips like around the globe to get stones, you're like just looking for exotic birds and stuff. Is that how it goes?
Same time. Yeah. What? Yes, at the same time. At the same time. The places in the world where amazing nature is also, you know, the places where there's great stones as well. So, you know, I travel as much as I can. I've been, you name it, I've been there. I mean, we've traveled all over the world, like looking for birds, looking for nature, looking for stones. And it's taken me, you know, just about everywhere. We're planning to go back to Indonesia in June, to Sumatra. I'm going back to Peru again. I just was in Bolivia. travel is, I love it. I just, you know, I can't get it. And the more you travel, the more you find out about more places to go. And it's not like the world gets smaller. Instead, it gets much bigger.
Yeah.
And the more people you meet and the more stuff, it's just, it's so much fun. I can't think of anything I like better than travel. I mean, it's so cool.
Same.
It opens your world up. It opens your world up, you know? It's like staying, you know, it's instead of, you know, I don't want a small life. I want a big life, you know? You know, how lucky are we that we're still here, you and I?
I know.
I mean, how many people we know that aren't? You know, like, think about that. Like, wow, I think about that all the time. You know, I'm grateful I am that I have the life I have. I'm able to do what I need to do. And I still have, like, my mind and my health. And I still enjoy every day.
Just both, like, knock on wood right now. I'm knocking really loud for both of us.
We're how lucky we are. We're so lucky, like, to still be here. I mean, if we think about who we started out with in this scene and who's still around, there's a lot gone.
Oh my God. You know? I know it's been like that in our scene, maybe more than like the average person seeing rock and roll. Always, like, there's always been casualties, whether it was called like car wrecks or drugs or freak accident, because we were born to be wild. No, you know, that's just what happens. But now, like, you and I are like bona fide senior citizens.
Hilarious, right?
I know, it's totally hilarious because I still feel exactly the same.
Inside in my head, I'm still like that kid.
Totally. Exactly, yeah.
I don't want to lose that.
No, I don't. Well,
not at all.
You won't, you know, we're having our second childhood, but without dementia so far, because we were always demented.
Right. Completely.
Yeah.
But, you know, we walked a path that people laid out for us, you know, people made a clearing in the weeds that we followed, you know, and like, and they're gone. It's like, you know, I'm so grateful for everything and all the people that showed me how to live and how to navigate this world. And I'm grateful for it. I really am, you know?
No, yeah, me too. I mean, this is also something like that probably neither one of us would have thought of saying in those days. Like,
no, you know, we would think back then like, oh God, they're so corny. Like, listen to those two old people being so corny. Like, I would never want to say that, you know.
But listen to those fucking hippies. Remember when hippie was the worst insult ever?
The worst thing. What about when the shows where people would set a fire to people's hair if it was too long?
Oh, I know. or one more thing I want to remind you of, and then we gotta go. Do you remember in the early punk shows how there was always like a bunch of hippies in the back doing like interpretive dance and all the, like, at the Damned, I swear to God, you
right.
That was the LA punk scene that nobody talks about.
No, absolutely not. Places like the Starwood, you know, there'd be like people that were left over from then still going there.
Yeah, that's right? What I mean. Yeah. The Starwood was like the palace of that. And that, like, the whole front would be rock and roll kids. And then in the back, it was people like direct from the Grateful Dead parking lot, just doing like crazy ass fucking ballet or whatever they were doing.
Do you remember, like, in the balcony at the Starwood, there would be this guy there with like a giant shag haircut. And it was that guy, Blackie Lawless.
Yeah, Blackie Lawless.
And he would come to all the punk shows and he was like a relic from another age.
Yeah. There was, I know, like, we could just go on and on about this, how I used to like stick my school notebook behind the bar at the Starwood. And they knew that I was like 16 and would just serve me anyway. And I wasn't the only one that was happening to.
Wow. I used to sneak kids in wherever we were, like at Lingerie or at Cafe de Grand. I'd sneak underage kids in. Like, they'd all go like, we need to come to your club. And I'd be like, okay, meet me at the kitchen door. Go in and open the kitchen door and they'd flood in and we're like, okay, great. And close the door.
I would do that at Cafe de Grand and at Raji's, you know, because I booked both of them. They were owned by the same people. I would just go to the kitchen door and let tons of people in. And some of them would actually come up and like pay. They'd like give their admission money and then run downstairs so they get lost and not get thrown out.
I would always tell people, like, mingle quickly, you know, blend in.
No one will recognize you. You've got a leather jacket and black hair. You'll blend in.
Right.
All right. Well, Joseph, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Like, this
likewise.
Go on and on and on. So that was Joseph Brooks. And catch the next episode of The Devil's Music.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lifted.
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. Please pick up these important and fantastic tracks.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.